This is The Guardian.
I'm Noor Haidar, coming to you from Gadigal land, and this is The Full Story. Two stabbing incidents in Sydney, 2 days apart, prompted two very different responses. Within hours, police designated the alleged attack of an Assyrian bishop in Wakeley by a 16-year-old boy a terrorist act.
Well, the New South Wales Police Commissioner made that determination at 1:30 in the morning based on information suggesting religiously motivated attack.
But the mass stabbing of mostly women at Bondi Junction was not.
It would appear that this is related to the mental health of the individual involved.
The difference in the way police treated them has triggered criticism and spurred two parallel conversations.
These two debates have risen up and prompted people to ask, well, what does constitute terrorism? When do we use that word and when do we not? And there's people arguing that by elevating the understanding of violence against women, that we then would have a greater chance of seriously addressing it and trying to change those awful statistics.
Today, rethinking terrorism and responses to violence against women. It's Wednesday, the 24th of April.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hi, Karen.
Hi, Noor.
Thanks for joining us. I want to start by talking about some of the events that have transpired over the last sort of week and a half. The mass murder stabbing in Bondi and then the alleged attack in Wakeley have prompted two intertwined debates about the use of the term terrorism. And you've written about this. Can you give us an overview of what's been said?
Yeah, I think we saw two incidents that had some similarities and some differences involving those terrible knife attacks in Sydney.
Karen Middleton is Guardian Australia's political editor.
And I think if you look at what happened at the church on the Monday night, an Assyrian Christian Orthodox bishop was stabbed mid-sermon at his own church in the western suburb of Wakeley. And police have designated that as a terrorist act.
At 1:35 a.m. this morning, after consideration of all the material, I declared that it was a terrorist incident.
And there was some concern in the community expressed at how quickly that designation was made.
Some community leaders are questioning why the attack at the church was labelled a terrorist incident, but the Bondi attack was not.
To rush to such a judgment so quickly has concerns.
There are just implications when you characterise actions in a particular way.
The newly appointed Race Discrimination Commissioner, Giridharan Sivaraman, is one of the people who's been uneasy about the speed of that designation.
Often a whole community gets tarred with the brush of one person, and it can lead to misinformation.
Sivaraman has been the Race Discrimination Commissioner only since last month, but he is saying that he fears that it could fuel racial prejudice more broadly, the speed with which that decision was taken.
We've seen it after Tuesday where, say, women with headscarves feeling scared to board trains because they're just worried about, well, what's going to happen? Is everyone going to be tarnished with the same brush? Am I going to be safe if I'm out in public? That's the ramification of the way in which you characterise things. That's why you have to be...
And then there have been other people looking at the event at the Westfield Bondi Junction and asking why, given that it appears that the perpetrator in that case was particularly targeting women, that wouldn't be designated a terrorist act.
Now, this attack may not have been declared an act of terrorism, but it certainly was terrifying. Michaela Cronin is Australia's Domestic, Family and Sexual Violence Commissioner. Michaela, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, David.
So, before we get to...
Now, of course, police are still investigating in both cases what may have been the motives involved. So there are a number of things that are still being examined. But these two debates have risen up and prompted people to ask, well, what does constitute terrorism? When do we use that word and when do we not? Especially when people are being terrorised in both cases.
I think that that's a really important debate for us to have as a community and to be looking at what the benefits and the risks associated with doing that are.
I want to go through some of those similarities and differences that exist between these two cases. Can you take us through some of the differences?
Yeah, and we should say, you know, this is very tricky terrain. This whole debate is complicated and difficult, and it's important not to try and oversimplify it too much. But if we look at, say, the differences, in one case, the perpetrator died. In the case of Westfield, in the case of the church, the alleged perpetrator remains alive and he is a child. In the case of Westfield, there were a number of fatalities. Mercifully, there were not in terms of the events at the church. There's also the issue of whether people were particularly targeted. So these are the sorts of things that are separating them out. And of course, there were different attitudes to the police in both cases as well. They were absolutely praised and lauded at Westfield for the swiftness of the response. And yet at the church in Wakeley, police were attacked. So we see a number of things that were not similar, even though there were a number of other things that perhaps drew links between the two.
Mm. And in the case of Bondi, police have come out and said that it seems that women were being targeted.
Well, the videos speak for themselves, don't they? And that's certainly a line of inquiry for us. It's obvious to me.
That's right. So we know that of the six people who were killed at Bondi Junction, five of them were women and the one man was the security guard who tried to disarm the attacker. And a number of women were also among the people who were injured. So there does seem, according to police, to be an intention to attack women there.
We don't know what was operating in the mind of the offender, and that's why it's important now that detectives spend so much time interviewing those.
So, Karen, can you then take us through the common factors, the overlapping factors in these two incidents?
Yeah, I guess, first of all, they're both knife attacks, which is a terrible common factor. In both cases, police have spoken about the people that are accused of these attacks as having been known to police. And in both cases, the issue of mental illness has arisen. There's been the suggestion of a history of mental illness in both cases. Interestingly, in the case of the church at Wakeley, mental illness seems to have been given a sort of secondary priority in the assessment of that to religious ideology or the religious pronouncements that the alleged attacker made there. Whereas at Westfield, it seems that the mental illness has been given much more prominence in assessing what kind of an attack it was. So while that's common, there's been a different weight given to the suggestion about mental ill health in both cases.
Mm. And Karen, that is at the heart of some of the questions that have been raised over the last week or so, with some community groups arguing that the terrorism label has been used selectively or inconsistently based on the identity or the background of the alleged perpetrator. Is that criticism justified in this instance?
Well, it's a bit hard to know because we don't know what the police know that we don't know. So I think you've always got to be a bit careful about second-guessing police investigations. Certainly, there's a part of that community who are very critical about the swiftness of the judgment to declare that a terrorist attack. And there is some concern, particularly in the Muslim community, that police are very ready to make that pronouncement about people who are accused of crimes who may have a Muslim background. So there's, I suppose, this underlying unease that's been in that community going all the way back 20 years to the attacks on 9/11 in the United States, that Muslims were being quickly accused. And in this sense, I suppose, members of the community have just said, why did you have to make that pronouncement so quickly when you haven't looked at all the evidence yet? So that's something that they've raised.
Mm. Karen, I want to take a step back. What is the legal definition of terrorism under Australian law?
Well, it's in section 100.1 of the Criminal Code, and it lays out quite a detailed definition. It's got lots of elements to it, but the three key elements relate to advancing a political, religious, or ideological cause. So suggesting that an act, which was an intentional act, was driven by some kind of ideology or religious belief is the key to that. It refers also to coercing or influencing the public or, importantly, a section of the public. And that is potentially an interesting statement when you look at what might constitute a section of the public. It then looks at the kinds of elements that also have to be present. It has to be causing death or serious physical harm. It puts a life other than the life of the alleged perpetrator in jeopardy. It jeopardises or puts at risk public health and safety, could cause damage to property, health systems, essential services, effectively. So these are all elements that need to be there. And what I guess people have focused in on when they're looking at these two cases side by side, because they happened in such close proximity, is the question of what constitutes an ideological cause and what constitutes a section of the public. And in the case of the Bondi Junction attacks, which appear to have targeted women, even though you could say they are a section of the public, and you might argue that misogyny, if indeed that was what was behind this, some form of misogyny or anger or frustration at women, then that could well be seen as an ideological cause. So it's a complicated and difficult debate, and one that the authorities are a bit uncomfortable about having, but certainly I think the community has started to have it, in particularly when it comes to the issue of violence against women.
Karen, you raise a, I guess, important point there that the definition leaves a lot up to the judgment of authorities and law enforcement in the immediate aftermath of an incident, doesn't it?
It does. There is still room for judgment. And New South Wales Police Commissioner Karen Webb spoke about it being her decision in the hours after the Wakeley Church attack, Christ the Good Shepherd Church.
We believe there are elements that are satisfied in terms of religious motivated extremism, and of course the intimidation of the public through that person's acts by attending that church whilst it was being live streamed, intimidating not only the parishioners in attendance but those parishioners who were watching online.
She felt there was enough evidence to designate that a terrorist incident, and that then has its own knock-on effect. There was a task force that was raised involving a number of different agencies, and they will look at that event through that lens. But clearly, there are judgments to be made by law enforcement officers and other security agencies about how to weigh up various factors. For example, we don't really know what judgment they make about the role of mental health and mental illness, and whether they look at the possibility that someone is driven by mental ill health to an ideological or religious position, or whether the religious position or ideology was held anyway and the mental ill health has just exacerbated and played a different kind of part in their actions. So there are certainly judgments to be made by law enforcement in working out how to view an incident and then what happens once that designation is made.
I want to talk about that point, about what happens once something has been designated a terrorist act. Can you talk us through, in a practical sense, what implications that has, and also why authorities either wanted or needed additional powers to respond to the Wakeley incident, but not the Bondi incident?
Well, I guess For starters, as we said, the perpetrator in the Bondi incident was killed, so there is no living accused in that case. In the case of the Wakeley attack at the church, there is an alleged perpetrator in custody. It's a young person, and police are going to want to be interrogating that person and about their motives, about whether they acted alone. A whole lot of other questions arise. What happens when something is designated as a terrorism attack or event is that it does unlock a series of powers for police that they would not necessarily have in the event of a crime that is not designated that way. So powers, for example, of detention and questioning, those kinds of things, which when you are dealing with an alleged perpetrator in custody, you would want as police to be able to ask those questions. So they've decided that there are enough factors that indicate that it was a terrorist attack that they can designate it that way and then unlock these powers of interrogation, questioning and detention, and that they hope then that they can come to understand the motivation. So the fact that one alleged perpetrator is alive and the other one is deceased is a significant factor, but it isn't the only element there.
We'll be right back.
Hey, Jane Lee here with a quick note about The Guardian. As you probably know, Guardian Australia's journalism is editorially independent, which means we set our own agenda. We don't have a billionaire owner, we don't answer to shareholders, so we're free from commercial bias. And this independence matters because it means we're able to challenge the powerful and hold them to account. Unlike many news organisations, we haven't put up a paywall. We chose a model that means our reporting is open to everyone and funded by our readers and listeners who can afford to pay. Every contribution, whether big or small, counts. So if you're able to support us, head to theguardian.com/support/fullstory. There's also a link on the full story page. Thanks.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Earlier, Karen, you talked to us about the definition of terrorism. What falls into the category of ideologically motivated terrorism, and would misogyny fit into that?
Well, it's an interesting question, Noor, because if you look at the most basic definition of an ideological cause, you'll see a description of a set of opinions and beliefs. Now, a lot of things could fit into that, and that is where I think people are asking the question about something like misogyny and a set of beliefs that involve hatred of women. The involuntary celibate movement, for example, is pointed to as a group of people that's become a movement that does seem to be linked by what may have started as a frustration with women that then becomes a hatred of women among a certain group of men. And there's been debate about whether or not that qualifies. And in fact, even people involved in security agencies have acknowledged that could well fit the definition. So one of the people who've actually raised this issue in the relatively recent past was the head of ASIO himself, Mike Burgess, who he gives an annual threat assessment, and the threat assessment that he gave in 2021 actually raises this very point voluntarily.
As a security service, ASIO's focus is on the threat of violence. In the same way, we don't investigate people because of their religious views. Again, it's the violence that's relevant to our powers, and that's not always clear when we use terms like Islamic extremism.
In a weirdly prescient address, he actually mentions both the frustrations of the Muslim community about being quickly designated as potentially involved in terrorism and ideological causes.
Understandably, some Muslim groups and others see this term as damaging and misrepresentative of Islam and consider that it stigmatises them by encouraging stereotyping and stoking division.
And also this question of whether involuntary celibacy, incel movements should also be considered in that way.
Violent misogynists who adhere to the involuntary celibate or incel ideology fall into this category.
And he actually said, you know, we need to change our language. We need to think more broadly.
Many of our Five Eyes partners have already changed their terminology for similar reasons. So at ASIO, we will use the two categories of religiously motivated violent extremism and ideologically motivated violent extremism.
Our agencies have this historical frame of looking at events of terrorism that involve religious or political ideology on a large scale, that they've thought of it in one particular way. They haven't necessarily broadened that definition out. And we are starting to see debate about whether or not there needs to be a rethink of how we define terrorism and what should be considered terrorism and what should not, especially given we're in a crisis in terms of violence against women. The statistics are horrific and, you know, something has to change.
Mm. Is there a political appetite to have that conversation?
Well, certainly when the Attorney General was asked about this last week, he was speaking at a family violence conference and he made the point that there is very serious concern about violence against women and the government is committed to addressing that. But he didn't like the idea of, he said, blurring the lines.
I have a text message that says, can we make it a terrorism offence to kill women? Maybe then more will be done.
I think we can talk about violence against women without blurring lines into something else. We've got a crisis of male violence in Australia. And I don't think debating definitions is the way to go.
So he was more thinking of terrorism in the traditional religious ideology sense.
And I think it's going down some kind of almost a wrong path to say, let's redefine. It's not about definitions. This is about action.
And Anthony Albanese was also asked about the issue of how these events are being defined.
Given that police say Joel Couchy appears to have been targeting women, should that attack have been classified as misogyny-driven terrorism?
Well, I'll tell you what shouldn't happen, which is politicians define these things rather than security and police agencies.
So in that sense, they're not wanting to have that discussion. They don't think that it's appropriate to cross those over. But I think in the community, the discussion is being had. And so maybe the government isn't necessarily keeping up with where the community wants to go in terms of a conversation about how we designate these things and what their expectations are about the level of resources and attention that are dedicated to addressing them. So it's not a debate that should be ignored. It may not be one that governments like to have, and they may feel that it isn't worth revisiting definitions of terrorism. But at the same time, I don't think they can ignore when the community is asking these questions and seeking some kind of response.
Mm, definitions aside, does this whole debate demonstrate that many people are not satisfied with the way that authorities and political leaders speak and respond to violence against women, and that we as a society need to shift?
You know, that's the big question. And I guess the trouble is when we start to have a conversation like this is when there is an emergency, when there is a terrible event in the immediate aftermath, and law enforcement and security agencies have very hard jobs to do. They are working to keep us all safe, and that's their primary objective, and they're not necessarily wanting to get into what might be seen as intellectual debates in some respects. But for a lot of people, they're not just intellectual debates, they're very practical debates, and there's people arguing that by elevating the understanding of violence against women, by suggesting that it is of equal status and equal concern to some other forms of violence, of our most alarming and concerning forms of violence, that we then would have a greater chance of seriously addressing it and trying to change those awful statistics.
Karen, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Noor.
That was Guardian Australia's political editor, Karen Middleton. You can find more of Karen's work on theguardian.com. And we've linked to her latest piece on the Full Story page. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Miles Herbert and Karishma Luthria. Sound design and mixing by Camilla Hannan. The executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. If you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe or follow Full Story wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also leave a review. I'm Nord Haydad. Catch you next time.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.